Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Exotics Club webinar. I am delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. And today, really sort of taking the story forward, looking at tracheal strictures in rabbits, and I suppose this is something that's become more to the fore of late when we've been looking at ways of managing airways in the rabbits. And I think I sort of want to start with a little bit of a recap, I suppose, just to sort of set the scene really for these. And obviously under anaesthetic we're very concerned about how we're going to secure an airway, how we're going to make things safe. And we have to be aware with the rabbits that they are near obligate nasal breathers, which makes life a little bit harder. Their soft palate normally is engaged and in front of their glottis. The mouth is long. You can't get much access into that. They've got long teeth. And they can be quite difficult to anaesthetize, particularly if you're taking time or you're starting to learn how to intubate rabbits. It can take some time to get it right that they are at the right plane of anaesthesia to give you the time to intubate if you're less experienced, to take the time to do that. And so some of these can take quite a length of time before you actually successfully get it in place and you're happy with your tube. Now, the position that is required to get these into the right position for intubation is quite awkward. The head has to be sort of elevated, and in order to get the tube in place, you do need to flip up the soft palate to get access to the glottis. So all of this together will lead to cyanosis and potentially apnea at the time of intubation because of the physical changes you're putting onto this system as well. And I think we do have to be well aware that them dying at induction, particularly with prolonged attempts or repetitive failed attempts at intubation, is a real sort of complication here. And I suppose we're looking then at their effective ventilation that we're impairing at that time, but we're also looking to things like laryngospasm, laryngeal edema that can be associated with repetitive trauma of this area attempting to intubate them. So we do have to be aware that that's one thing, and I guess that's a different thing from tracheal strictures. This is trauma associated with the action of intubating at the time, if that makes sense. So we obviously want to try and make this as safe as possible before we go through this process and look at ways of minimizing that. And so capnography we do use quite a lot. If you think you've got an animal that may be under respiratory compromise, then capnography can be very important to get an assessment of whether this animal is or is not suffering from underlying respiratory complications or compromise before you start anaesthetizing it. So very, very useful as well. I would say pulse oximetry is, yes, less useful, but if you're saturating and breathing room air, you should be around 97% saturated by default, really. Blood gas, I'm just putting in here as well. If you're really thinking you've got a compromised patient, then doing an arterial blood gas will give you a very detailed picture of the oxygenation and ventilation of that patient. Again, okay, maybe not an option you may have access to, but nevertheless, if you want to look at the metabolic status of this patient, it's very important. Now, I suppose if you're saying, okay, well, let's think about how we're going to go about getting this animal tubed or what we're going to do. Whichever agent you use, if you decide to avoid intubation and go, you know what, I'm just going to mask induce my rabbit, that's what I'm going to do, they will breath hold in response to smelling the SIVO or the isoflurane, maybe up to 2 to 3 minutes they will do that for that. And your end-tidal CO2, your RTO CO2 will elevate and they will struggle. So if you've got an animal that you're thinking is in respiratory compromise, then masking it down isn't really going to help you there. And of course, if you're using induction agents, which we'll come on to as well, particularly propofol or alfaxolone, you'll get apnea associated with your induction agents as well. So here you've got your anaesthetic agent, mask or injection, plus anatomy, plus the change in anatomy required to tube, plus depending on your experience and things as well. So the sort of things we need to be thinking about here really is we must be pre-oxygenating these. In people, healthy people, the risk of hypoxia during intubation is quite low. If you've got significant underlying respiratory disease, then even with pre-oxygenation, it's still a significant factor in people. So really, effectively, we're saying that all of our rabbits potentially have underlying respiratory disease. They hide it well, so they all will benefit from pre-oxygenation. And what the essence of your pre-oxygenation is giving you a buffer before the patient reaches critical hypoxic levels. So if you're trying to intubate a rabbit, we know there's a risk of it going hypoxic or hypercapnic. The longer it takes you, the more attempts you try, the greater that risk. If I pre-oxygenate you, I am buying more time before you become hypoxic and I have to abort what I'm doing in order to reoxygenate you for that simple reason for them. And basically, if you were breathing, you know, as a person now in human medicine, if I was breathing room air and then I was unable to breathe, I may start becoming hypoxic within 45 to 60 seconds. So the question is if you've been trying to tube rabbits and practicing the technique, how long does it take you to tube the rabbit from start to finish? If you're talking more than 45 to 60 seconds, then you have got a hypoxic patient. So in human medicine, the aim is to go from 97% saturated, which a healthy person should be, or whatever saturation point you are at, if you've got respiratory compromise, to elevate that to 100% saturated, or as close to that as much as possible. And being 100% saturated will buy you more time. And in people, what they recommend that you do, and obviously they can tell us how to breathe at induction, is you exhale as hard as you can. You then would breathe oxygen for 3 minutes normally. Or what you would do is breathe 4 to 8 deep breaths of oxygen. And in a person, with over that time scale, you will oxygenate yourself as best as you can to 100%. And if you don't get to 100%, another 3 minutes of oxygen probably is not going to make any difference. This is going to happen with that 3 minute period or within 4 to 8 deep breaths. And I suppose if you look at it that way and say, okay, if you swim and you're going to go diving, how many deep breaths do you take before you dive? Do you mean it's a very quick, right, I'm going to do that now, a prolonged period of oxygenation or deep breathing before you go for a dive isn't something you would do automatically. So we do have to think about how long to pre-oxygenate for, and I guess by inference 3 minutes is kind of your far limit of that. Any more than 3 minutes is probably fairly pointless. The body position of this rabbit is very, very important. And I guess we have to be aware of that we're going to potentially put them under respiratory compromise because of the position in which we are holding them or manipulating their neck. And certainly in people, there's a massive difference when you're pre-oxygenating your patient, whether they are lying on their back, for example, or whether they are sitting upright. And sitting upright and being oxygenated is far, far more effective than lying on your back. So for our patients, again, we need to make sure that the chest is elevated, we're not compressing the chest or the abdominal contents, it's easing back from the breathing. Getting them in a more vertical position will ease the breathing for them and allow them to oxygenate better based on how we've got them held. And on the human side of things, looking at that, if you were to take, say, 8 deep breaths of oxygen before you were anaesthetized and then you went into an apneic crisis, you've got 8 minutes time before you become critically hypoxic. If you just breathe room air, you've only got 1 minute. I mean, it is a massive, massive difference, the extra effect of safety that pre-oxygenation makes on patients. And I suppose if we decide to just for a minute jump to the side, how many people are pre-oxygenating their dogs by face mask before they induce them with a propofol, for example? This is a massive, massive significant thing that you want to be doing for all of your patients, really. So the way that I would practically look at this as an application would be to pre-oxygenate these animals prior to applying local to the glottis. it takes 90 seconds for your interviews to work. So for me, I wait 90 seconds for the interviews to work, and I'm pre-oxygenating during that time period, and at the 90-second point, I'm then going and intubating. Now, you can put a circuit over the nose of the rabbit while you're intubating. That's fine if they're nasal breathing. I guess that's helpful. The moment you flip up the soft palate, they're going to be breathing through your otoscope cone, if this is what you're going to be using, and breathing the room air as you're going to intubate them. Now, okay, if you're giving nasal oxygen, you're still going to oxygenate the nasopharynx. But of course, a lot of the oxygen may be going over the back of the soft palate, down sort of in the esophageal region, not coming down where the glottis now is, because of course you've changed the anatomy back there. But you're not going to do any harm. And some people, like I say, do like to continue to oxygenate them at that point. I've got no objection in that, but I'm not convinced how much of a benefit that's going to be offering these cases at that stage. And I suppose the next question we have to ask ourselves is, how many people do tube rabbits? And it's about 40% of the minute, maybe creeping up, of people that would be tubing rabbits. So it's not an easy thing to do. It's not something that everybody would be doing. But I think it is a good standard to be aiming for. And I suppose my answer would be that I would sit in favour of intubating all anaesthetised rabbits, even for dental procedures. As much as the Broadbelt study said, oh, it's not really essential for short procedures, what I've certainly found in experience is that if you're doing a dental without an intubation, it's just a quick burr of teeth. Before you know it, there's pus in the mouth, there's blood in the mouth, you're trying to extract a tooth, and you just push it that little bit further than you perhaps planned, and then you can get aspiration of this material and lead to further respiratory compromise. So for me, there is a logic in intubating every rabbit to be on the safe side, because you end up with a secure airway. And bear in mind, some of the supraglottic airway devices we can use, which we'll just be talking about later, they're not really something you can put in place for dental disease, simply because you need access around to get access to teeth. So for me, for intubation, I like to get direct visualization of the glottis. Reduces your risk of trauma, reduces the risk of you inadvertently pushing food or bedding material down into the glottis. And we're normally using a 2 to 4 millimeter ET tube. Most of your standard rabbits will be on 2.5 millimeter tube, 2 millimeters maybe for Netherland dwarves, and once you start getting into sort of 3, 4 kilo rabbits and above, then you're onto 3, 4 millimeter ET tubes needed. And depending on how you do this, we actually, for a lot of cases, will have an introducer, specifically because we're teaching students, really, to some extent, because it's easier to observe the introducer go down into the glottis. And then once you pass that in, you can then choose your appropriate tube around that. But personally, if I'm doing it solo, then I'm not using the introducer. For me, that's an extra step to go through. And again, of course, we're concerned about respiratory compromise. So going from non-intubated to intubated as quickly as possible is actually, you know, better from a rabbit point of view, to reduce morbidity and things. So just to recap, we do have a lot of reasons that make intubation hard. This is just a little list of them again. The soft palate being in the way, the tongue, laryngospasm, repetitive attempts. We can't open the mouth fully. All of these things can make our life much harder. For me, with these, I am using an otoscope, ideally one that's specifically kept for that purpose. And you want sort of the long nose cone, really, for most of these. You'll get away with a medium-sized cone for the Netherland dwarves, but for the bigger rabbits, you do need the longer cone. You need to get perfect restraint. You've got to get the head elevated at quite a steep angle. You need to get the tongue manipulated and moved out to one side. You need the rabbit to be sufficiently relaxed to make your life easy to do this. And like I say, you're basically then hyper-extending the neck to achieve this. And you want the tongue put out to one side using forceps or your fingers. You're sliding the otoscope cone in the other side of the mouth. You'll see the soft palate. You'll see the epiglottis behind that as a very pale sort of V-shape at that time point. And you can see in the picture here, pictures here, we're still pre-oxygenating these rabbits here onto their nose whilst we're trying to look at the soft palate. This is a sort of view that you will get. In the middle on the soft palate, you have absolutely no real vessels or anything. It just is plain tissue. And you'll have your epiglottis sitting behind that. Now, at this time point, if you're looking at your rabbit and it's too light, what rabbits tend to do is to jerk their head ventrally because of the angle you're holding them at. And if that's the case, the edge of your otoscope cone will ulcerate the edge of that soft palate, and you can get blood being produced with an aspiration risk at this point. Now, that's not a dramatic crisis. It's not normally enough to be of concern, but nevertheless, it is an iatrogenic complication that we do see. Never had any long-term consequences from it, but you will see it. The trick is not to panic, get an airway in quickly once you've got the patient suitably anaesthetized, because, of course, what you don't want them is to be aspirating all that blood and then going into respiratory compromise because of that. So once you've done that, you've seen where you're going, you've flipped up the soft palate, which I'll show you again in a second, the rabbit will then breathe out of your otoscope cone. You'll be able to see the glottis. They will go cyanotic at this point. This is going to put them into respiratory compromise, so be well aware of that. And then you need to basically tube this rabbit whilst you're doing it under direct visualization at this time point. So I'm just going to take you the steps through of how you'd go about tubing them. Once you've flipped up this soft palate, what you've got very nicely is soft palate here. This is your glottis here, epiglottis here. If you're using a stylet, you need to feed it ventrally at this time point to make sure it doesn't try and flip off. So I always sort of aim as ventrally as I can. Off to the side of your soft palate and glottis, you have the venous plexus, and sort of about here, you'll have a tonsil just out of view here. So if you're seeing the venous plexus or tonsils, you're off to the side, move to the middle where you don't really have any blood vessels. Now, depending on how you do this, this is an ET tube being measured in place to make sure we're going the distance that we want to go down to. We're pulling the tongue, pre-oxygenating here, finding our glottis. And the trick is, once you've found your glottis, once you've got direct visualization, you must put your intubes down on here to stop your laryngospasm. So we'll visualize the glottis, make sure we're seeing it. We'll spray the intubes down through the otoscope cone, and we're going to watch that trickle down onto the glottis to ensure that we've got it in the right place. Having done that, we're going to wait 90 seconds for the intubes to work, continue to pre-oxygenate this patient while we're doing that, and then once we're happy that we've done that, we then can go ahead and intubate this patient. Again, if you're going to use an introducer, that's fine. You can use a urinary catheter to do this. You can feed that down, the otoscope, down through into the glottis. Once that's fed in, you can pinch it off to hold it, slide your otoscope off, slide your tube on, and you'll find with this, once you get down to hit the glottis, you'll sometimes find you get a little bit of resistance to manipulating this through into the glottis. At that point, a slight twist or a flick on the ET tube can allow you to get it in. And having done that, then obviously it's going to slide down into place quite nicely. And then you can take your stylet out. If we have a little look now at just a couple of videos just showing us that sort of step-by-step process. So this is the first video really for you to go through. And this is basically looking at an anaesthetized rabbit. We're going in, looking to see the glottis. We've got the glottis nicely in view now. We're now going to get our local down through the otoscope directly into place into this rabbit. We're then going to take everything out of its mouth. The soft palate by default will flip back into place, sort of come back to being an obligate nasal breather again, at which point then we can give it 90 seconds of O2 over its nose. And maybe, depending on how deep it was at that time point, you might wish to give a little bit of a top-up of your induction agent, whichever you're using, to take it a little bit down further to buy you a little bit more time for the actual intubation process. But with a lot of rabbits, you can get local on when they're quite light still, if you haven't quite given them enough at that point. And then, so, of course, plan B after you've done that, and this is the second video to show you now, is we're now going back in now, having put the local down and pre-oxygenated. We're now going back to find our glottis. In this case, it's me doing it on my own without an introducer. I tube rabbits for some bizarre reason like a right-handed person despite being left-handed. I guess that's just persistent student teaching that have made me do it that way. But now we're feeding this tube through the glottis directly, making sure we're happy. And I guess it's important, really, thinking about it, to look at the length of time for this video between getting this rabbit in a position to do this through to getting the capnograph on and setting up and things ready for putting it onto oxygen again. And that video length is about 42 seconds. So that is about at your limit of your 45 seconds without pre-oxygenation before that patient was going to go significantly into compromise. So, you know, even if you're used to doing these, it takes you time to get things organized. So I suppose moving on now from getting your tube in place, we do have to be aware that there are some complications that we'd rather try and avoid, I guess. Once you're happy tubing rabbits, it's simple. You do get some protection against your aspiration. The obstructing, once you've got it in place, is unlikely. Very useful for dental procedures, very useful for bullar osteotomies, very useful for rhinotomies or this sort of type thing, incisor removals, for example. There is a potential for trauma that is significant. You can get some aspiration despite that. If you've got a cuff in place, you will cause mucosal damage. Bear in mind, you might miss and go into the esophagus, and bronchial intubation is also a possibility. You may risk cross-infection between patients, and if it's blind, then, of course, foreign body aspiration is significant as well, and I would not be encouraging anybody to be doing blind intubation. And just an example here, this is just a rabbit that's been sedated here, that's decided it wants to eat lettuce just at the last minute, and this is the piece of lettuce that we pulled out under direct visualization that had sat at the back of its throat, which you need to remove. And so if you're saying, okay, great, this is of concern, put them onto newspaper, they'll do the same with newspaper. They'll do the same with a towel. Anything this rabbit has access to whilst it's been sedated, it could potentially eat. So really, it's quite difficult to avoid that completely. And if you were going to intubate them blind, the two things I would suggest that you do is, one, you need to make sure that you have local on your glottis. And to do that, you must see it go on. The second thing is, if you want to avoid foreign bodies, is you've got to go in and look and ensure there is no foreign bodies in the mouth, looking right back to the glottal area to do that, which means you then have to see the glottis to see that. If you are capable of going in and viewing the glottis to check for foreign bodies and viewing the glottis to put local down there, you're probably capable of viewing the glottis to intubate it too, because you can find the glottis routinely and easily and see it. So for me, blind intubation has no role whatsoever for these patients. And even if you were considering using a supraglottic airway device, the same principle applies. You need to anaesthetize your patient to go in and have a good view to make sure the oropharynx is clear, because I've been in the circumstances before with supraglottal devices where you have used a device and it's pushed material that the rabbit's then aspirated as a consequence of using the device. So you need to know you have a completely clear oropharynx and glottal area, and the only way to do that is to visualize it directly. Okay, you could argue whether you need local or not for a supraglottal device, but given that they are actually engaging with the larynx, which is how they're meant to do that, which is part of how brilliant they are at that, I still think some local over that glottis would also be a benefit, and the epiglottis particularly. And so Going in and visualizing that and getting local on it is something you need to do before you switch on to a supraglottic airway device. Should that be your conclusion, you wish to use that at the end of this discussion we're having, really. Some of these you find, particularly for using an otoscope, as I would do, you have to have a slightly longer ET tube to slide down through the otoscope. This means if you insert it to the length you think is appropriate, you can get down to and hit the carina and get it into a bronchus or have problems with ventilation, which is exactly what we've got here with this radiograph I'm showing you here. Be very mindful of that. You also want to have your patient suitably anaesthetized. If they start bouncing around on the end of your ET tube, when you come to extubate the patient at the end of it, if you end up with this scenario where you've got fresh blood on the end of your ET tube where you've been manipulating your patient under GA and maybe for doing laparoscopic surgery, for example, which is where we've had problems with intubation where you're manipulating the patient a lot, we do have to be aware. If you're seeing this coming out of your tubes after successfully intubation, then I would be very fearful for you getting a high incidence of strictures, and maybe if your intubation technique is poor or anaesthesia technique is poor, you should be looking at an alternative. And tracheal edema, fibrosis, stenosis, it's real. Happens all the time with these. So you do have to be aware of them. Okay. There's been a few reports of strictures put in into the literature. This is Nikki Grint's paper going through signs of that. And obviously it's something we've also seen at Edinburgh as well with that. And I guess from our finding for these cases, you're seeing them 4 to 5 days post-anaesthesia is when they start to show signs. On post-mortem, you can get debris behind the larynx, I guess, depending if you're having injury at that point. Or, like I say, if it's further down in, you may have it always generally occurring at the end of your ET tube to some extent. You'll get fibrosis, you'll get stenosis, you'll get some congestion, and you may have edema and hemorrhage, depending whether you're looking at laryngeal trauma at the time of intubating or whether your larynx has got away with it, but what you're dealing now with is a stricture at the end of the ET tube. And I think really those are the two bits you've got. You've got laryngeal injury, you've got stricture as kind of two separate things, and your edema and hemorrhage is more a reflection of laryngeal trauma. But if you do have hemorrhage on the end of the ET tube, as I just shown you, then I would be concerned at that point where it started to irritate the mucosa, that's asking for a stricture to occur. So for these, we wouldn't want to have any pressure in a cuff. We're not going to have a cuff here at all because we're worried about getting mucosal trauma. And obviously the cuffs, if you've got a cuff present, you will see that trauma where the cuff has gone into it as well. So you always want to go for an uncuffed tube. Okay. Wide as you can do, fitting there easy without bouncing them across all of the tracheal rings as you're trying to place this tube in. Be aware of the weight of the circuit. Some of these where we're mechanically ventilating, and the argument here is that if you're mechanically ventilating, you may get some degree of vibration at the end of the tube that may lead to a factor, but also your mechanical ventilation is quite heavy, and that can put weight onto this and put more traction on the tube, which can then lead to movement and more concerns as well. So we do have to be aware of that as well. And obviously moving, manipulating the patient. I've put laparoscopic surgery here as one where you would want to have a secure airway, but where there may be complications because of manipulating that patient. And obviously, we do have to be very careful. And most vets, when you're placing ET tubes, are quite poor. In that once it's in place, you're happy with that. And you'll rotate your patient around without rotating your tube in concert with the patient. The tube might move in and out a bit, and we don't really care. In human medicine, they're very particular that when your tube is in place, the tube no longer moves. It is held in place with you. And if you move, the tube moves with you to try and minimize the trauma at the end of that ET tube as it's being manipulated and moved around in the patient. It's important, don't wash them in chlorhexidine because that can cause an issue. And even if you do and you clean them, one of the arguments that we've got here as a predisposing factor for stricture formation is that you've got dried chlorhexidine residue on the tube, and once you put that tube into a warm, humidified environment, that dried residue can leach contents into the trachea at the end of the ET tube. Hey presto, be a major predisposing factor for inflammation at that site, causing a stricture. We want topical lidocaine in place. You need lubrication. You need to have the right plane of anesthesia to facilitate tubing to make it easy. And either try for a set time period or number of times to reduce the risk of death. And like I said, within 45 to 60 seconds, you're going to compromise that patient without pre-oxygenation. With oxygenation, you've got a better time period. But bear in mind, the whole manipulation and changing of the head, rabbits are going to be compromised way, way quicker than other mammalian patients for repetitive intubation attempts. So I honestly would have 45, 60 seconds as my cutoff. If I haven't done it by then, I've got to reoxygenate this rabbit. And bear in mind, in your recovery period as well, we want to be closely monitoring these things as well. Don't go leaving these guys unmonitored. So if you're getting a stricture, what do you get? Well, arguably, you start to see signs 4 to 5 days after intubation. And I think the point to make is you have a healthy rabbit. I know that seems madness what we're saying, but this rabbit comes in many cases they're eating, drinking, weeing and pooing, they'll be passing feces, but the owner's going to be bringing them in, reporting a funny noise when they're breathing, and obviously as a stricture develops, then you can get marked signs, and we have here on this rabbit here, we've got mouth breathing here, and I'm going to show you a little video of this mouth breathing rabbit. This rabbit also has a stricture, but to all intents and purposes, it's coming in as a healthy rabbit. It's a healthy rabbit that just can't breathe. But this is quite distinct to a pneumonia where you have a sick rabbit coming in, which is feeling quite groggy as well. This is another lovely stricture case here showing orthopnea here. Again, nice, healthy rabbit. It just happens to have a stricture too. And if we start looking at how some of these are behaving, so this is a stricture here, but I just want to watch this rabbit behave and see what it does as well as part of this. And you can hear the noise it's making. I will play the video again. But you've got a rabbit that is active, mobile, running about, eating, drinking, weeing, pooing, doing what it should do. But obviously, it's obviously got a very genuine noise being created at the point of stricture. And this is absolutely classical appearance. They are very, very distinct from a pneumonia or anything else. They are absolutely typical. And I guess for people that are seeing this in some of the macaws, for example, if you're dealing with birds, very, very typical. This is a case that's progressed more severe now to open mouth breathing. So again, healthy rabbits, but you get to this point where breathing has become so compromised by the stricture. This obviously is fatal, but now you've got a rabbit that's suddenly gone into gut stasis that's not eating, and that obviously is of concern at that time point. Now, if you want to confirm your diagnosis, so you've kind of got, from clinical picture alone and history, this is almost classical, really. But if you want to confirm, you can go for radiography. And certainly in this case, and this was a rabbit that underwent a laparoscopic spay, you can see tube here is probably too long, but we've got a stricture here right above heart base quite nicely. Radiographically, it is very clearly evident. You won't always be that lucky, it has to be said. I haven't gone through CT images, but we've got some CT images of these. A lot of the rabbits, we will actually do conscious mousetrap CTs, which works very, very well. I mean, we're doing probably 3 or 4 of these a week now. And the rabbits sit beautifully for this to be done, and we're getting really, really good detailed images. So if you're looking at dracheal strictures, the CT works fine. The slight downside you've got against CT for these is normally CT is quite commonly used for strictures because you get a feel for the length and severity of strictures if you were dealing with an esophageal stricture, let's say, for example. With the tracheal strictures, they are pinpoints at the end of your ET tube. That is exactly where they are. And they may be less than a millimeter in thickness. And on a standard CT where you're going through and you're taking 1 millimeter slices of that patient, it is possible that you could have a tracheal stricture in between two CT slices and miss them because your millimeter is either, you're just either side of that 1 millimeter stricture. So, and that's again with radiography, you may find it looks normal because you cannot detect it because this is a pinpoint stricture, not a stricture over any distance or length. So although your imaging is helpful, it may be more of an issue, certainly for me, is saying, okay, the chest is clear, there's no other pathology, it sounds like a stricture, it's going to be a stricture, let's go and have a look at it in a different way. For me, this is ruling out other pathology, so I know I am just dealing with this. But bear in mind, if you're thinking you want to anaesthetize your patient to get a diagnosis of a stricture, it may not be helpful. Given the clinical signs and the timing, you should be already thinking about it. And just some post-mortem signs here. This is, you know, being honest, these are difficult and problematic cases to try and resolve and sort out. And so, unfortunately, some of our patients may not make it through this process. And what you're seeing, basically, on this poor rabbit's case is we have a nice normal trachea all the way down, and boom, this is our point of stricture just at that point. Beyond that, we're fine, but it's literally just at the end of that ET tube where we're seeing this stricture. And if you cut these a different way and transect them, this is really what you're talking about here. This is a stricture point. But you can see this tissue is quite thin. You can see behind that everything works fine. It's this tissue that is our concern, and it literally is just at that point where it's reacting all the way around the trachea. And if you look at histopath, again, not really detailing it here, but normal section of trachea, beautifully perfect. Stricture here, where we've then got obviously massive inflammatory response here, an acute inflammatory response with hemorrhage and bits and pieces, compromising the tracheal lumen very, very markedly. And this obviously is fatal, so this has to be diagnosed and dealt with. So what's the first thing you're going to do with these? I guess when you're seeing these cases coming in, if you are convinced they are stricturing, first thing you do is you get them into oxygen, and you're probably going to nebulize them as well. And for me, for all my sins for these, much as it's equivocal in human medicine, I'm reaching for steroids for these, topical nebulization with steroids at that site for these as well. Then I guess you may want to be reaching for systemic non-steroidals for them afterwards, for anti-inflammatories. Maybe if you're thinking there's some infection here, you might be going for an antibiotic. That certainly is an option for you as well. Some people would use bronchodilators and things. Not convinced how a bronchodilator is going to help the situation. This isn't bronchial constriction. This is fibrosis and scarring of the mucosa. But you could argue if you're able to widen the tracheal diameter by the use of bronchodilators, maybe that will help them. And certainly we have used bronchodilators on these for a little while as well. One that can help, which is an interesting addition for you here, is the midazolam. And you find with a lot of rabbits, as you will be aware, anaesthetizing these regularly, that if you were to recover them or stress them out, they start hyperventilating, which means they basically poorly oxygenate because they're ending up breathing too rapidly or they become too anxious. And some of these can become very anxious with this, which I think would impair them to oxygenate effectively. And a little bit of midazolam just to relax this patient down enough that it breathes more sensibly and isn't dashing about in a stressed fashion can be quite helpful. I think analgesia is good, never a bad thing. Probably something like buprenorphine would be adequate, but if you're planning on going in and doing something about this stricture, then we need to be proactive about that. An IV line in place and fluid therapy, And obviously an IV route for emergency drugs, definitely needed, so you need to get your IV line in place for these as well. Assist feeding is a difficult one, because these are normally healthy rabbits that aren't in gut stasis, certainly in the earlier stages. But, of course, they're focusing so much on breathing, particularly if they are now forcibly mouth breathing, your risk of them aspirating something you're giving by syringe feeding is actually quite markedly, a real risk in these. And for me, I would be concerned about going crazy with the assist feeding at this stage. I'd rather be looking at resolving the respiratory problem more than panicking about assist feeding. So just be cautious with that. This is a case that you may end up causing compromise by accident because of that. What you do need, however, is you do need to be endoscoping these. If you want to confirm your diagnosis, and you can see here the nature and extent of a classical stricture here in a rabbit, and how much this lumen has reduced from where the endoscope is looking, you've got to see what's going on. And it's all this tissue here that's got to be broken down to give this rabbit a chance at having a better airway, really. Now, for that, then you're saying, okay, what I need then is an endoscope that I can fit down a rabbit's trachea. And as we said, a lot of these rabbits are on 2mm, 2.5mm tubes. So arguably, for most rabbits, a 2.7mm ET tube, 2.7mm endoscope would probably get you down to visualize your stricture. And certainly, I know people that have been struggling, they've used the endoscope almost as a bougie large, but basically to go in and push through the stricture to try and break down the inflammatory tissue, because they can't really do much else, because the 2.7 scope is filling your trachea. So you also have an animal now that's respiratory compromised that, in effect, you're intubating with a solid endoscope that's not going to help you. That puts you in incredible risk. The way that we manage these, really, is we have a 1.9-2.1 endoscope, which fits down quite nicely. That has with it a surgical sheath, and the surgical sheath in combination with the endoscope probably is about 2.7 mils in diameter. In other words, we'll be able to get this unit in combination down to the trachea, down to a stricture point, in pretty much all the rabbits that we're seeing with this. And I say all the rabbits, we're probably talking half a dozen cases over the years, but nevertheless, you know, this is a technique we've ended up finding is the best way forward. The beauty of the system in place is that you're able to visualize your passing of the endoscope all the way down into the point of stricture. If you want to do biopsies, you can then slide your biopsy forceps down via the endoscope sheath, so you're not risking doing further trauma to tracheal rings by sliding it down the trachea on the way in, and it gives you obviously a much safer way of trying to minimize further damage by the technique that you're doing. So more old school here, intubation, but again, you know, you've got to get access around these to have a better look. And for most of these patients, because you're here for some time, you can't really restrain your patient in the same way that you would for doing intubation or even a quick tracheoscopy, because you've got to get this patient stable so you can work on its trachea for quite some time. And so for me, for these, I'm then switching to having them positioned on their back, which is very similar to the technique that some people use for intubation in the first place for these. But in that position, my rabbit is nice and stable. It's got an IV line in place, ready for emergency drugs. But obviously, I can manipulate the tongue, going with the endoscope, and view trachea and glottis and see what's going on. Just to an aside, if you don't have an endoscope small enough, I guess you could go for tubing followed by tracheal washing. If you felt you want to try and get some tissue from here to confirm it was a stricture or get a culture out, that's possible. And this is just basically showing you a tracheal wash via an ET tube in a rabbit, so you could slide this down to the point of stricture and then sort of try and get tissue that way, or even suction back on your catheter and try and get aspirates of tissue that way as a possibility if you're really desperate to try and get these under control. And obviously that can go for culture and cytology when you're done. I guess with the setup that we're using for these, and we're quite fortunate to have the equipment that we have, is we can use the biopsy forceps to either push through the stricture, open the jaws of the biopsies under or back to break it down. We can use the biopsies to grab and remove tissue directly at that point to break down the stricture tissue, but also get a biopsy for histopath and a biopsy for culture. And also what you can do is slide a cut-off urinary catheter down the endoscope biopsy sheath. So you're talking probably a sort of 4 to 6 French catheter, depending on the size sheath that you're using. But that can go down and be used for aspirating mucus, fluid, again, to try and break down that stricture. And obviously, also, you can go and put topical treatment directly onto this stricture. So if you're a fan of the steroids, you can slide this catheter down and you can drop anti-inflammatory steroid directly onto the stricture site topically, so you know you've got there. What you must do is provide oxygenation throughout this treatment, because in effect you're intubating this animal with a solid tube that doesn't provide any additional ventilation. There is a real risk of this patient trying to crash during this process. So the way that we've managed to get away with that quite nicely, and this is just showing one of the cases here undergoing a workup here with Jenna and me, and what we've actually got here, we've actually connecting using a special metal connector here made by Vet Instrumentation here that we're using to connect to one of the insufflation ports of the sheath, directly connecting our O2 going in, which we'll either use with a circuit or just with a catheter going in. But this is oxygenating down that sheath into the animal. Now, admittedly, you're finding with a lot of sheaths where you're using the side ports, the flow rate of fluid and air can be impaired because it's trying to squeeze past your endoscope. So what you want is to have a bit more space between your scope and the sheath. And certainly with these, when you don't have instruments or a catheter placed down, you've got a really good oxygen flow rate down what is the instrument port, because it's all one and the same. And then when you are sliding your instrument in, admittedly that is compromising the oxygen flow to some degree, because now you've got an instrument down the sheath as well. But obviously, your oxygen flow is continuous going down there. And we have actually also managed to get some degree of capnograph readings as well with these intermittently through the other biopsy port on the sheath as well. So again, not perfect, but what we're trying to do is use our endoscope sheath to secure the airway, facilitate oxygenation, and obviously also to facilitate anesthesia. So these are getting more sevoflurane down via this port as well. And what we found is that we've been able to satisfactorily stabilize anesthesia without the need for any additional IV top-ups or anything, using sevo and oxygen down through the endoscope sheath. And like I say, intermittently we're getting some of the odd capnograph reading when the rabbit's exhaling, depending on what we're doing, which is giving us a feel for the end-tidal CO2 as well. So not perfect on the end-tidal CO2 readings at all, but better than nothing, and it gives us a little bit more assurance that maybe this patient is doing a little bit better. And basically, really, to minimize the risk of trauma to this patient, you kind of got to have one person taking charge and responsibility of holding the scope critically still, so you're not causing any further trauma to the soft tissue structures in the trachea. Obviously also observing breathing and things, with the second person manipulating, doing the biopsies and breaking down of tissue. Trying to do this solo, you're going to risk trauma. And certainly if you've got your rabbit held up in this direction, it's an impossibility. If you're going to have a go solo, you've got to have them on their back, if that makes sense. But like I say, you can get catheters down these as well, and these are quite useful for topical application of anti-inflammatories or additional breaking down of tissue if you were struggling with your forceps or something, or you were lacking forceps small enough, then a urinary catheter can slide down this port and do exactly the same job for you. For these, you've got to have an IV line in place. These guys are going to risk crashing if you don't. You need to have that in place to ensure that you've got the ability for more IV drug therapy, you've got an ability for emergency drugs to go through. Definitely give them some buprenorphine as well. I would definitely go for midazolam, and for a lot of these, my induction agent of choice for these really would be something like alfaxolone. Propofol would also be fine, you know, pick your choice. But get them intubated with your endoscope as quick as you can and keep your oxygen and sevoflurane going through there. And like I say, the system doesn't work, it's not perfect, but we found it works okay and gives us plenty of time to manipulate and deal with these throughout the process where we are breaking down these strictures. Obviously, on the recovery side of things, these are going back into oxygen, they are continuing with nebulization, with steroids maybe, antibiotics, prokinetics, anti-inflammatories, bronchodilators if you wish to alongside that to try and ease things. And obviously the whole point is what you're hoping is you're not going to restricture again in another 4 or 5 days as a consequence of your activity. And that's why being meticulous with these and how you're managing them to do that. I suppose what we're not discussing today is you do have the option of doing a tracheal resection, but the same issue then is you've got to try and secure the airway before you do that. Your resection has to be in a convenient spot that you can do that. And as we've shown you with some of these, if you're going to be intubating with your tube running into the thorax, which I would advise you against, but if you do end up doing that, clearly if you've got a stricture that's intrathoracic, your problems are just being multitude by a magnitude of fold here to try and get this sorted out. Your alternative, like I say, for intubating, as we've mentioned before, is to consider using supraglottic airway devices like the V-gel. These do work beautifully. I would advise you have capnography monitoring with these. The important point is, in contrast to the tube, whereas we are lazy with our tubes and we allow these to roll around and you know, move in and out, with your V-gel, slight rotation of the airway device in the mouth or rostral cord or movement of that device will lead to compromise because you haven't got the glottis secured nicely. And to some extent, we have to learn to manage these slightly differently to tubes. Ironically, we're managing these like we should be managing our tubes, in that we are keeping them in place and we're not allowing them to move within that patient. This, like I say, is plan B if plan A doesn't work. And it's your clinical judgment call, I guess, on whether you're looking at going for a supraglottic device and are happy you're going to manage these effectively, or whether you feel your intubation technique that you're using and the way that you are controlling all the risk factors that we've mentioned is sufficient to really make the risk of stenosis and issues, you know, really minimized. And like I say, from our point of view, the cases that we have seen, we've only seen these post laparoscopic procedures where we are mechanically ventilating our tubes, manipulating the patient a lot, maybe using higher pressure than normal to counteract for the pressure of CO2 in the abdomen, so your ventilator pressure set slightly higher. You know, this is where we've seen this as an issue in these. Being aware it's an issue, doing our best to minimize it, but even so, we're still seeing them coming through. And we've certainly seen cases referred in to us from other practitioners where they've had stricture formation, but that's been seen in routine spays and castrates and things as well, where maybe their attention to detail in how they're managing the tubes is a little bit less. That is the end of our presentation. I do have a couple of questions that have come through. First one is the use of steroids. And obviously that's something that we don't take lightly. But for me, I feel it's something I've got to try and do something to help this patient. And even though the jury's out on their effectiveness, nevertheless, I think it's a worthwhile doing. For me, I'm probably using about half a mg per kg of steroid as a maximum dose. But what I'm really doing with aiming to do with these is to get, if we're using IV dexamethasone, for example, at 2 mg per mil, what I'm using is enough steroid that I can then apply that directly onto the stricture site as sort of straight IV steroid, really. So for me, it's as much as I feel I need at that point without overloading them with steroid, using half a mg per kg as my top dose. If I'm nebulizing, I'm using 1 mil of the dexamethasone with 9 mils of saline into the nebulizer chamber, and that's being nebulized sort of twice a day for 30 minutes. If I feel the urge to nebulize with a bronchodilator as well, we are, or something like acetylcysteine to try and clear out mucus and things, or we might be using bromhexidine as well, I suppose, orally. If you are going to nebulize with more than one product, then obviously split your nebulization sessions up and use a fresh chamber. And again, we're doing sort of 30 minutes twice a day. Second question that's come through is use of antibiotics for these. I think given the inflammatory response that you're getting here, much as you don't tend to get infection in them per se, I do worry that if I'm going to start breaking down material within the trachea, I'm going to risk setting up infection. Okay, you could arguably, if we've been lovely and sterile with our technique, and obviously our surgical sheaths are autoclaved, although our endoscopes are currently cold sterilized, or they are rinsed in Medis is what we use for them, but we are thoroughly rinsing this endoscope absolutely completely before we're putting it into our surgical sheath. If you're worried about infection starting, I have a greater concern for anaerobes, given this is within the tracheal lumen itself. I think deep-seated anaerobic infection in these is less likely, and like I say, ideally, get yourself a biopsy for culture if you want to. But for me, things like fluoroquinolones would be a perfectly fine, suitable first choice for these, should you be wishing to give some antibiotics to your rabbit undergoing this sort of procedure. That is the end of the webinar now. I'm going to pass back to Emma to finish. Thanks very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.